know, most of Trump's supporters are making $75,000 a year. Whoop-de-doo. That person should be making $125,000 a year.
If the Republicans block all the key initiatives that Democrats and the American people want to see pass under President Biden, they may just change the Senate rules.
If you're going to go to the theater to buy a ticket, it's because you want to talk to a person who can tell you that for a piano performance, you want to sit house right where the pianist is if you want to see the hands.
For me, it reinforced how much unions need communities and communities need unions.
So much of school is language-based, so much of relating to other people is language-based, and that's the deficit area for our students. So we try to place students based on their academic skills and needs, but also their language modality and language needs.
For the listeners out there who are considering this stepping up in your leadership role or your connection to the union, it is a great, great way to start giving back to the organization.
I'm not staying 10 feet away. I'm not staying 2 feet away. I'm like basically making love to a propeller. I'm wrapping myself around it. I'm looking at it in every little aspect possible. And if somebody turned an engine on, it's a blender.
So my pitch to them was that no, equal work for equal pay. I said, if you join the union, this is what we fight for. This is where we can help you.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got a great show today, a little bit of everything. Teamsters Local 808 President Chris Rivera discusses the one-year anniversary of the death of George Floyd on Workweek Radio. AFL-CIO Director of Government Affairs Bill Samuel reports on the status of the PRO Act on America's Workforce Radio. Then, from Your Rights at Work, Scabby the Rat and the Fat Cat team up to save jobs at the Strathmore Music Center just outside Washington, D.C. We'll find out how community solidarity in Glasgow, Scotland stopped a forcible deportation on the Union Dues podcast. From Radio Labor, we'll hear about the Bangladeshi garment workers' fight for jobs and a living wage. And America Works returns for a second season with underwater marine diver Jim Mercer describing his year-round job checking, maintaining, and repairing commercial fishing boats in and around the port of New Bedford, Massachusetts. On CTU Speaks, we find out about the special challenges deaf students face. And from Grit Northwest, we get insight into the role of union delegates. Our last report comes from On the Line, Stories of BC Workers, with their story of uniting Asian workers in the lumber industry. I'm Chris Garlick for the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, and like I said, a little bit of just about everything today. Remember, you can find today's shows, along with more than 100 more just like them, at laborradionetwork.org. And if you enjoy the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, please be sure to like us and share. Solidarity works. Here's the show.
This is KPOO San Francisco, 89.5 FM and KPOO.com on the internet. This is Steve Zeltzer with Workweek. This is the one-year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. I'm with Chris Silvera, who is the president of IBT Local 808 in New York and New Jersey, and he's been a leading activist in the movement to defend Black and worker rights and also for internationalism. So welcome to our show.
Hey, man, good to see you.
So, Chris, we're coming on to the one-year anniversary of the murder of George Floyd. What are the lessons of the George Floyd murder and the movement that's arisen to protest this systemic racism, and also what working people need to do to end this terrorism against Blacks, Latinos, and others.
So a part of this, I believe that the labor movement has to speak up. The labor movement has to say something to make that connection. One of the things that people are not doing, people think that things happen in a vacuum. So at the same time as you are having a civil rights movement in the United States, you are having an anti-colonial movement throughout Africa and the Caribbean. And these things are happening all over the place. Now, with respect to George Floyd, George Floyd and that conviction does not begin to address the problem. The problem can only be addressed by dealing with the reality of these police believing that they are above the law. Truth in fact is, and I tell this to people all the time, the police is an extension, it's an arm of the state, right? So when you see them protecting the police, they're not protecting that individual police or even that department. They're protecting the state. And so that the racism which is driven in America that results in these murders and what have you, we just saw this happening in Gaza, in which Israel is shooting rockets at, you know, defenseless people. I mean, I'm not sure about the rockets, who them guys are getting rockets from, but they need another rocket maker. But the fact is that what they have compared to Israel's arms is, you know, it's a guy bringing a knife to a gunfight. You know what I'm saying? So that societally, we have to address how our society sees and values Black skin.
The rise of fascist movements, right-wing, openly fascistic movements in the United States, what does that mean from the point of view of American workers? And what should American workers be doing about it? Because the rise of fascism and racist, open racist, is that a threat to the trade unions? Is that a threat to working people?
It is an absolute threat to the working class as a whole. People don't realize that the Klan was anti-union, and that in the years when they were trying to organize in the South and whatnot, it was the Klan that came in to drive union organizers and to defeat those organizing drives of labor from back in those times. So racism is anti-working class. But one of the things that people don't understand is that the working class is actually in a situation where right now, between the behavior of the Fed and just general corporate, unbridled corporate greed, the working class is probably 40-45% behind where they should be in real wages. So you're making $70,000, you're making $80,000, but you can't do anything good with that money, right? So even though you're saying, you know, somebody goes, oh, well, you know, most of Trump's supporters are making $75,000 a year. Whoop-de-doo. That person should be making $125,000 a year. So that pressure on their lifestyle, because remember now, they're growing up in a country that taught them that being white gave them this leg up. And I'm looking around and I don't have that leg up anymore. Matter of fact, I'm looking around and none of us have a leg up. But what happened? They're not seeing my leg, that my leg is not up. They're not looking at the Latino making $70,000 and seeing that he or she, their leg is not up. They're just looking at themselves because they live in this world that tells them I'm the only thing that counts. But the fact is that the working class has been under the duress of the Fed and unbridled capitalism. That is what's causing this tension. And labor has been unable to articulate, or refuses to articulate. I think they even might know about it, what it is that's going on. But, you know, if you're in certain unions, that racism works to your advantage.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. We've been talking with Chris Silvera, president of local IBT 808 in New York and New Jersey. And this struggle is obviously going to continue. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you for what you do, Steve. Keep up the work, man.
Great. Take care.
Stay strong. All to the people.
This has been Work Week Radio on KPOO. Thanks to our audio engineer, Cosme Torre. You can reach Work Week Radio at labormedia1@gmail.com. You can also find us on SoundCloud at Work Week Radio. Solidarity has no borders.
15 months lost in Iraq. We got stopped.
Welcome
to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Bill Samuel, one of my favorite guests, yours as well, I'm sure, is going to be our first guest today. Mr. Bill Samuel joining us on our live line, as he does each and every month, on the last Thursday. Hard to believe that May is almost over with and we got the holiday weekend coming up. So you were telling me that you're gradually getting back into the Labor Federation building in Washington, D.C., and I know it was under attack a year ago after the George Floyd protests, and there were fires in the lobby and all that. So slowly but surely you're getting back, and I understand that you're starting to meet face-to-face with some senators to talk about the PRO Act. So where are we right now, Mr. Yeah. Samuel?
Yeah, we had been meeting like everybody else over Zoom, so it's not like we haven't been talking to folks on Capitol Hill really right through the whole pandemic. But now we're beginning to open up the building. People are coming back to work. D.C., Washington, D.C. is opening up slowly. We got to pay attention to safety protocols. And if you go into our building now, there's lots of signage about keeping distant and getting temperature checks. It's all still a little bit iffy. News is good, but we're not out of the woods completely. Anyway, so we were on the Hill yesterday. President Trump and I were meeting with Senate leaders about the PRO Act. I think we're in as good a shape as we can be right now. We've still got three Senate Democrats who are not co-sponsors of the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, the landmark legislation to make it possible for workers to organize without getting fired or threatened. And those three, two are from Arizona, one state, and one is from Virginia. I think we'll get them eventually, but we want help from the Senate leadership, and we want a commitment that when we get to 50, we'll bring it to the floor. Now, that begs the question, because obviously with the possibility of a Republican filibuster, I shouldn't say possibility, with the certainty of a Republican filibuster, we might need 60 votes. That's what it takes to overcome a filibuster. I think what's happening now is Democratic senators are thinking seriously about changing Senate rules. You know, it only takes 51 senators to change the rules. You don't need 60 votes to change the Senate rules regarding the filibuster. And if the Republicans block all the key initiatives that Democrats and the American people want to see pass under President Biden, they may just change the Senate rules. And pretty soon there's going to be a debate about S1, Senate Bill 1, which is this big democracy package to protect the vote against what's happening in legislatures across the country. Republicans will filibuster that, and that may provoke a fight about Senate rules. Right now, Mitch McConnell has veto power over the entire congressional agenda. It's as simple as that. If he leads his Senate Republicans to filibuster, his 40 votes can kill any measure that the Senate takes up. So we're going to, the AFL-CIO has taken a historic stand now in the last couple of months to end the filibuster. Filibuster's only been used in the past, I say only, mostly to stop civil rights legislation. That's when it first came about, and then to stop labor law reform dozens of times over the last 50 years. So that's where we are on the PRO Act. We think the House passed it in the first weeks of the session with Republican support, by the way. We had five Republicans, every Democrat in the House but one. So we're up to, and the president, as you've reported before, talked about it in the State of the Union address to a session, joint session of Congress. He said, pass the Protecting the Right to Organize Act, put it on my desk, and I'll sign it. So these really are different times. Public supports it. We've got 63% of the last poll I saw supports passage of the PRO Act, including almost 50% of Republicans, about 80% of Democrats. So I think there's reason for optimism, which is, I don't always say that when I don't believe it, but I believe it now. I think there is real reason for optimism.
I know the three Democrats are getting some pressure here. And I was talking yesterday about Mark Warner, the Teamsters in Virginia, gathered outside his office in Richmond, and then went to his home in Alexandria saying, come on. Pass the PRO. What's wrong with you?
Really, Mark Warner's, they're all individual. They're all unique, all 100 senators. He wants to be at the table. He wants to negotiate. He's got his own ideas. All these senators have their own ideas, and I understand that. At some point, I think you have to pull together as a party. If you want to be the party that labor says it stands for, working families and organized labor, you got to sometimes say, okay, I'd like to change a comma here or a period there, but I'm willing to co-sponsor and get the bill to the floor. I think he's inching his way there. I wish he'd be a little bit quicker about it. We'll be talking to him, and as you said, his own constituents are talking to him in Virginia. Arizona's tough. We've got two Democrats there. I guess you'd say it's a purple state between Democrat and Republican. So both Democratic senators are hanging back. I think they're basically just stalling. This is Mark Kelly, who just got elected, and Kyrsten Sinema, who's now in her fourth year. I think we're going to get them eventually, but time is running short. The session, you know how these congressional sessions go? In January and by summer, people are talking about the next election, which is still a year and a half away. But the window does close, so we need to get busy.
Bill, they're still counting the votes from the last election.
I know, this is an odd year. This is, you know, it really, as you said, they're still auditing. They're bringing in private companies who have no experience and weird names like the Ninja Turtles or whatever this group is.
The Cyber Ninjas.
Cyber Ninja. Yeah, and then of course the experts say now the machines have all been tampered with. We can't use them again. I don't know. You'd cry if you weren't laughing so hard. But
I know. And taxpayers are going to have to foot the bill for the new machines.
And we're paying for it. Yep.
Yeah.
For a small handful of kind of lunatic, you know, conspiracy theorists. You know, as they say, you know, the inmates are running the asylum right now in some of these states.
Boy, you're not kidding. All right, yeah. Mr. Samuel. We're going to run here. You take care, my friend. Enjoy the holiday weekend here. Stay safe, and we'll talk to you at the end of June, all right?
You too. Thanks.
That's it for another edition of this show called America's Workforce. Coming up tomorrow, our Working Class Perspective segment on Amazon and the steelworkers supplying America. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening. And be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.
You are listening to Your Rights at Work at WPFW 89.3 FM. Now, speaking of bad bosses, problematic bosses who think they are above the law, we got one out there on Rockville Pike, and I'm talking about the music center at Strathmore. And I'll be honest, and I said this at a meeting the other night, some bosses, and we had somebody on from Washington Gas last week, they're owned by an out-of-town corporation, and I don't mind beating up on them. When I have arts organizations that are not stepping up and doing right by their employees, it's a special pain. And so to help me understand what's going on out there at Strathmore, we've got the business agent from IATSE, Local 868, and that's Ann Vantine. Ann, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about Strathmore. And you're right, it's especially during pandemic times when arts workers have suffered so greatly. Many of us have not been working for more than a year now. And Strathmore is an employer who's using the pandemic as an opportunity to replace their workers with kiosks and machines. We've been in negotiations with them for over a year now. We had an agreement in April that they've reneged on and proposed reversing a lot of the gains that we had made, and now want to eliminate all full-time positions entirely and turn everybody into part-time and reduce the number of people they do employ, and let kiosks and machines do the work of the ticket sellers. They're claiming that the pandemic is forever changing the climate of the arts, which is a false narrative, in my opinion, in that it is changing for the better, not for the worse. We anticipate greater interest in the arts. People want to come back to see the arts in person. So we're expecting it to be busier, not less busy. They're also disrespecting and disregarding the talent and skill that ticketing professionals bring to the table. They're claiming that because of the pandemic, people don't want to purchase tickets in person. They want contactless ticketing, hence the kiosks. And that 90 plus percent of tickets are sold online, which may or may not be true once we're back to a more normal. However, they're negating to recognize all of the work required behind the scenes to enable people to buy a ticket however they purchase a ticket. They just don't magically appear on the web for people to buy. There is work done in the background that allows tickets to be sold online, and that is the bulk of the work that they seem to want to disregard. That they're basing their decision merely on how busy the phones are, and that is no longer the important work that we do. A lot of it's customer service, it's online customer service, it's setting up the system so things can be sold behind the scenes. If you're going to go to the theater to buy a ticket, it's because you want to talk to a person who can tell you that for a piano performance, you want to sit house right where the pianist is if you want to see the hands. Or for dance, you might want to sit further up if your ideal purpose for watching is to see the formations, where someone else might want to sit in row A to see the feet and the toes. You can only find those things out when you have a conversation with the ticketing professional who knows the ins and outs of the theater and the seats they're selling. A computer can't answer those questions for you.
We're going to have to roll, but just wanted to remind folks that 5 o'clock this Sunday, and I know that it's a Wynton Marsalis, and I love Wynton, and I know it's a sold-out show, but anybody... There's two of them, that's right.
Yeah, 6:30 and an 8:30 performance.
5 o'clock, y'all are going to be out there. I know my friends from DSA are going to be out there. I know Elise is picking me up. We're going to be heading out there. So 5 o'clock up there on Rockville Pike. You can go to dclabor.org, click on calendar. We've got all the details. There's a link where you can even sign up and find out more about what's going on. Also, Anne, at our council meeting on Tuesday night, there was an offer from the folks at Smart to send over their fat cat to go along with the rat. So are we going to have a cat and a rat?
I hope so. I didn't see that email till this morning, so I replied to it. But the more the merrier is what our lawyer said. So
well, if the lawyer said it, it must be true.
Thank you, everybody, for your interest and for supporting us. We really appreciate everyone.
That's Anne Vanteen. She is the business agent for IATSE Local 868. That's the folks that sell and take your tickets and just make sure that you can get into all the arts that we want to go back to. So let's make sure that happens.
Welcome to the Union Jews Podcast. The UK's only All Things Union podcast, designed for your downloadable digital delight and appreciation.
Now, thought for the week with Glasgow University Professor of Work and Employment, Mel Sims. You'll recall, I'm sure, a couple of weeks ago when the immigration services tried to deport a couple of chaps and pick them up on the south side of Glasgow, and immediately found their vehicle surrounded by about 200 people from the local community. Mel was amongst them. And her thought for the week in this episode is all about the links between community activism and trade unionism.
Since last podcast, I've had the privilege of participating in an act of community solidarity that's had such resonance that it's hit the national and the international news. On the morning of the Muslim Festival of Eid, two streets from my house in the south side of Glasgow, an immigration raid seized two men with the intention of enforcing a deportation order. Within minutes, a small number of neighbours had surrounded the van, and one quick-thinking activist slid underneath the van to prevent it from moving and to buy time for a network of locals to gather. Within about 2 hours, there were about 100 people present, and that grew through the day so that by the late afternoon, my estimate is that there were around 300 or 400 people in the road. And of course, a very heavy police presence. by the late afternoon, early evening, in my view, the standoff could have ended in many ways, and most of them really not that nice. But behind the scenes, local politicians and immigration lawyers were negotiating with the Immigration Service with the police, so that by 6 o'clock, the doors of the van had opened and the men were released to a local place of sanctuary. And that cheer that went up in the crowd when those van doors opened reinforced every reason for me why community organising is so very, very important. Glasgow as a city has had a long history of grassroots radical activism. And I've only lived here for 3 years, but I realised very quickly that my trade union networks meant that I had the contact details of many of the protesters who were in the crowd and who were closer to the van than I was. We could exchange messages about what was needed, what was happening around the protest and how the situation was developing. And there are many reasons for hope and joy as a result of the events that day in Kenmure Street. But for me, it reinforced how much unions need communities and communities need unions. Also, how local action is so very deeply embedded in international collectivism and solidarity. And as they say in Glasgow, welcome, because we're all from somewhere.
Well, that's about it for this episode. Thank you so much for spending your valuable time in our company. Hope you've enjoyed what you've heard. Hope it's made you think. Let us know what you do think. Ideas for future guests, ideas for future shows, things that you thought didn't really work so well, don't try them again. You can email the show at unionjews@makesyouthink.com. You can tweet us at Jews Union. And it would be great if you could subscribe to the show or leave a review of the show or both on the podcast platform of your choice. Thank you very much indeed. Union Jews is part of the Labour Radio Podcast Network. That's a collection of 100 shows linked to trade unions and the issues that trade unions deal with. You can access all those shows through a common portal, which is at labourradionetwork.org. That's all one word and no U in Labour. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks' time when we'll be dealing with all things data. We'll be talking to someone who has a unique job title in the trade union movement. They are a head of data. What does that mean? What does it involve? How do you get to be a head of data anyway? All that coming up in our next episode, which will drop on the 8th of June. Till then, stay safe, look after yourself, look after each other, and I'll see you next time on Union Jews. The Union Jews podcast is presented by me, Simon Sapper. It is a Makes You Think production.
From the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
Welcome to America Works. Excerpts from longer interviews with contemporary workers throughout the United States collected by the library's American Folklife Center as part of its Occupational Folklife Project. This is AFC staff folklorist Nancy Gross, and this America Works episode features marine underwater diver Jim Mercer. Jim works on commercial fishing boats in and around the port of New Bedford, Massachusetts. It's a unique, challenging, and dangerous job. Jim, who grew up in the New Bedford area, loves it. He was interviewed by Madeline Hall Arbor on behalf of the New Bedford Fishing Heritage Center as part of the American Folklife Center's Archie Green Fellowship Project, Working the Waterfront, New Bedford, Massachusetts.
So how did you get started with this?
Family business was a dive and ski shop. My mom's brother was a diver and actually got my dad into diving in the 60s sometime.
For recreational diving?
Yep. They said, let's open up a store. And then my dad started teaching sometime in the 50s. He was a dive instructor. So my dad stuck me in the water in the 70s. I remember getting into a wetsuit with some soapy water and squeezing into it. And that was, the rest is just history. The first job I did was probably 14 years old. I cleaned a couple of tugboats in Fairhaven. And that I should have. That was a really tough job. I should have known from then on that it was going to be tough. But I always just enjoyed the. I enjoyed getting guys off and running. It's a good feeling when you watch the boat go out and you just checked it and you know it's good and so on. On a day-to-day basis, I wait for phone calls and take care of the fishing boats in the water, on the bottom, looking at the propellers, the coolers, the intakes, the transducers, the zincs, and any other problems that they might run into along their trip.
So what kinds of things are you looking for?
Well, the obvious would be rope in the propeller, which sounds simple to everybody else, but a few extra barnacles or any growth or anything that possibly went through the propeller to disturb its function. Maybe like a bend or something that wasn't there the last time.
So is that how people know to call you? Is that something's just not right with a...
Yeah, there's a checklist that the captains have, and it will just say diver on there, and then the shore engineer will call me, or the owner will call me and say, okay, you know, we got to check for the diver. Let me know what everything's looking like. If the boat's sitting, they're going to call the diver after it sat, and I'm going to put more time on the boat. It's the first thing that I look at is the propeller. After that, it would be a good look at the coolers. A lot of the larger boats, if you see them out of the water, they have these, it's basically a radiator. It's outside the boat. And the barnacles love to grow on it. Barnacles or worms or mussels or whatever you might have would bother the cooling. So it would be propeller, then the coolers, and then sometimes the obvious stuff, changing pipes on the inside, changing valves on the inside of the boat. They need me to block up the vents. Standby, they block them, they fix them. You know, some guys are into the tractors and whatnot, but I was always into the boats, the bottom of the boats. Every day is pretty dangerous. Every day, it's not easy. I say this lightheartedly, but they say, you know, go and check the propeller. I'm not staying 5 feet away. I'm not staying 10 feet away. I'm not staying 2 feet away. I'm like basically making love to a propeller. I'm wrapping myself around it. I'm looking at it in every little aspect possible. There's 4 blades and 5 blades and 3 blades. And looking at the blade edges, and if somebody turned an engine on, it's a blender. Right? It's not, you know, every day is dangerous, and nobody wants to be the guy that turns the engine on when the diver's down there. There's not too many other people that'll do it. There's not too many other people that'll do it and stay with it. There's not too many other people that'll do it and be comfortable. It's a unique job, and it's what I like.
You've been listening to commercial marine diver Jim Mercer from New Bedford, Massachusetts. He was interviewed on behalf of the American Folklife Center as part of the Archie Green Fellowship Project Working the Waterfront New Bedford, a year-long documentation project directed by folklorist Laura Orleans. She and her colleagues at the New Bedford Fishing Heritage Center recorded the voices and experiences of some 60 Massachusetts port workers. Their stories are now a permanent part of the Occupational Folklife Project at the American Folklife Center.
Welcome to this episode of CTU Speaks, Deaf Berries and CPS.
Homie, I was taught by a Chicago teacher, Chicago teacher, Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher, so I'm inspired by the fight from my Chicago teachers.
I am your co-host, Andrea Parker, and I'm joined with...
Jim Staros. How you doing there, Miss Parker? Or I should, wait, I should say Dr. Parker.
Yes, Dr. Parker. I'm like you now, Jim. We got two doctors in the building.
Oh, doctors in the house. Double doctors in the house.
Double doctors. Nice. I like that.
got some good guests today. We've got some guests. They're going to tell us about some of the issues and concerns there are with the deaf and hard of hearing population in Chicago public schools and some of the potential solutions to these problems. We are here with two wonderful guests, Kelsey Cavanaugh, an American Sign Language interpreter, and Krista Valencia, a middle school teacher of the deaf. How are you guys doing today?
Good. Thank you so much for having us, Jim and Andrea.
So maybe you can start off with giving us some basic vocabulary demographics on the topic to help us understand the issue better. So like, for example, like how many deaf students we have in CPS?
Any number that I give you right now is going to be like an extreme guess. I think that kind of speaks to a bit of an issue in and of itself. So I've been providing services for deaf and hard of hearing students in CPS for 11 years. As an American Sign Language interpreter, I go into the classroom with the student and I facilitate communication between deaf and hard of hearing students and then their hearing teachers and their hearing peers. And I've been doing that for 11 years in CPS, and I have no idea about any of these numbers. And Krista and I actually work with the same population of students, and we've never met before. So we don't really get time to collaborate with each other across the district, which would be really helpful given the very specific skill set that we all possess for this like very specific group of students that we work with. But if I had to ballpark, I would say it's at least a couple hundred students, maybe between 200 and 300. I know we have four high schools that have programs, and then we have 5 or 6 elementary schools that have programs specifically for deaf and hard of hearing students. But then we also have students throughout the district that would be in their neighborhood schools with maybe itinerant teacher services and interpreter services in their schools.
Wow.
So how is this lack of teachers and program impact the family communication with students?
Wow. Yeah, that's a big question, because you're really touching on the heart of a lot of our issues here. And that lies in the communication, because deafness does create a barrier to communicating within the hearing world. Hearing families who happen upon deafness in their children have a lot to learn and unlearn about deaf culture and how deafness can impact a person's development. And these are things that a lot of parents don't have the time or resources to learn. It is kind of a knee-jerk reaction, I think, of any human, of any parent, to protect that child and try to give them everything you can to make them successful. Typically, those hearing parents, the first person that they talk to about their child's hearing loss is a doctor or an audiologist. And doctors and audiologists love to solve problems and fix things. And so it is often the case that the doctors and the audiologists will kind of push a family toward what we call oralism or an oral route. And that focuses a lot on speech and listening. So giving a child lots of speech and language therapy, a lot of auditory rehabilitation. This is where children are given cochlear implants at a very young age. That is a surgery that is irreversible, and it places a device inside of a student's head that bypasses the hearing organs that are inside of your ear and goes straight to the brain. These are all strategies to set the child up for success in a hearing world where written and spoken English are the main languages that the student will be used to be evaluated on and communicated with. However, deaf children, in fact, all children, benefit from the use of sign language. So much of school is language-based, so much of relating to other people is language-based, and that's the deficit area for our students. So we try to place students based on their academic skills and needs, but also their language modality and language needs. And it seems like in the past, there was some confusion or some conflating the two. I had a student in the past who was really intellectually high functioning, but parents are deaf. He's deaf. So like his English language was considered to be low. He was a low reader and writer, but incredibly smart kid. He exhibited a lot of behavior issues because he was at an oral school and he signs at home and he needed that communication at school as well. And so he would become very frustrated because he was misunderstanding or being misunderstood. And so it was determined by the IEP team that he needed to go to a school with more signing people. So we sent him there. And that school at his next IEP meeting said, "Why did you send him here? He's too smart to be at this school with the signing students." And that kind of broke my heart because there are certainly a lot of deaf individuals who sign, who do not speak English, who are incredibly smart and very talented. So we try to place students at schools based on what they need academically, what language would best suit them.
So thank you, Kelsey and Krista, for coming. We really appreciate you. And I know that this issue will go out to the masses. And I know that we're going to be just better advocates for our deaf and hard of hearing students, because that's what we're here for. We're here to service all of our students, and all of our students are worthy of the best education possible. Thank you all.
Thank you guys so much.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you all so much for listening to this episode of CTU Speaks.
What do you do?
What?
What do you do?
I'm in construction.
I don't feel like you're in construction.
Union delegate.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the Copacabana is proud to present the king of the one-liners, Henny Youngman.
This is Don Stover, delegate of Local 146, and I've got grit.
That line by Ray Liotta is from the movie Goodfellas. And even though being a union delegate has its perks, getting front row seats at the Copacabana isn't one of them. Chances are your local delegates are made up of members just like you, bag-wearing carpenters who take their job seriously and want to give back and make a difference. Delegates are elected by the members to represent their local union at the regional level and to play an important part in shaping the direction of our union. Delegates bring forward and vote on decisions that can affect the lives and livelihoods of their constituents and their families. These decisions include operating budgets, organizing direction, and political endorsements. Delegates are also responsible for electing the executive committee members, including the executive secretary treasurer, or EST, the president, and the vice president. The role of the delegate is hugely important in any well-functioning organization. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Northwest Carpenters representative, Local 146 member, and union delegate, Don Stover. Hi, I'm Joe Cadwell, the writer, producer, and host of Grit Northwest. I started our conversation today by asking Don what led him to first become a union delegate.
So when it was first presented to me, it was a mentor of mine that said, "I'm going to nominate you as a delegate to Local 1065 back probably in 2008, 2009, and I asked the question, "What is a delegate?" And he said, "You'll get the opportunity to be a representative of this Local 1065, meaning you will put the locals' interests and you will represent the locals' interests at a higher level, which is at the council level." And I thought about it and I said, "Of course." And so he nominated me and I had the opportunity to be a delegate of Local 1065, and I got to represent the Local 1065 and its passion about the crafts that were within our local. I took that to heart.
So the delegate role is something that basically is the connection between your local and the inner workings of the regional council. You have to be a member in good standing for 2 years to be able to accept that nomination. And just to be able to nominate someone, you have to be a member, as far as I know, in good standing for at least 1 year in order to be able to nominate someone. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I will tell you this, as I know for a fact, I held a recording secretary position at 1065, and I got 3 months behind on my dues, and I was let go. I was. The president came out and said, "I'm sorry, unfortunately." And that was my doing, and it was my mistake. Not that I didn't have the money. I just didn't follow through with my monthly obligations. And I let it get behind. And I would tell you, because it really, instead of walking away, I came back. I took a little time because I went home and it was heartfelt. And I really wanted to be a part of that. And I really wanted to be, but I didn't let it deter me. I made sure from then on out, this individual, I took ownership of that bill. I didn't let it be on anybody else. And I paid that every month since that time. I then got my position back a year later, had to be voted in, had to be nominated. And I worked my way up to president there at that local. And that's how what it meant to me. I wasn't going to let it deter me. It did affect my heart because I really want to be a part of it. But hey, I had to learn the hard way, and it was a good way. And I've never been late since.
A little bit of a reality check got you back on the straight and narrow. So for the listeners out there who are considering this stepping up in your leadership role or your connection to the union, it is a great, great way to start giving back to the organization. All right, Dom, thank you so much for taking your time to be on the show. It was great talking with you, brother, and we'll see you at the next delegate meeting.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate you. You're doing a great job.
My guest today has been Don Stover, delegate from Local 146. If you or someone you know are interested in becoming a delegate for your local, there's no time like the present to get involved. Be sure to attend your local meetings for more information. Next week's show, I speak with Paul Gallivan, Northwest Carpenters representative, about the role of the job site steward. Well, that wraps up this episode of Grit Northwest. Until next time, this is Joe Cadwell reminding you to work safe, work smart, and stay union strong.
Welcome to another episode of On the Line, a podcast produced by the BC Labour Heritage Centre, designed to shine a light on the rich labour heritage of British Columbia. I'm your host, Rod Mickleborough. This is Asian Heritage Month. Last month was Sikh Heritage Month. Both groups are justly celebrated for their contributions to the fabric of British Columbia. At the same time, they also suffered many years of exploitation and discrimination, much of it in the workplace. For many reasons, including the racist policies of many unions, they were very hard to organize. But one union, the International Woodworkers of America, met the challenge head-on. The IWA concluded that the best way to break down racial hurdles in BC sawmills was to hire Asian-Canadian organizers. It was a groundbreaking decision. Roy Ma, later a prominent leader in Vancouver's Chinatown, was hired to organize Chinese-Canadian lumber workers. As part of his job, he put out the first Cantonese Union newspaper in North America. Roy Ma talked about his experiences some years ago with well-known chronicler Paul Yee.
Yeah, I was a district representative for all of BC, except the interior. Well, I edited the paper for them in Chinese, and then also I also was organizing. I go around to the camps and try to organize them because they were working at 40 cents an hour, and some of them got as little as 25 cents, whereas the white were getting 60, 75 cents. You see, there was quite a spread in the wage differential. So my pitch to them was that, no, equal work for equal pay. So I said, if you join the union, this is what we're fighting for. So this is where we can help you.
Did many Chinese join?
I say I got 80% of them.
Was the IWA one of the first unions to try and organize amongst the Chinese?
Yes.
Why were they so interested? I mean, organized labor for a long time earlier had been very much opposed to the Chinese. You know, they said they're lower wages and unfair competition, and
yeah, but then that's 20% is a sizable chunk of the working force, and if you can't, you can't ignore them or leave them out, you see, because if you leave them out, then they'll always be working undersell their labor to the boss.
So they figured it'd be better to pull them in than to sort of leave them as enemies.
It's just a matter of convincing them. Right. A lot of them were skeptics. They were hesitant, and they don't know, you know, some of them were afraid that the boss might find out and fire them, you see. you know, they were so accustomed for years to sort of treated as doormat, you know. And they don't know the difference anyway, because, you know, that's their the way of life for so long. Then you say, gee, they were so accustomed to receiving 40 cents. You suddenly offer them about 85, that's double, you know. In those days, that's equivalent to, say, jump $500 to $1,000, you know. I think it was reality even. We show them, you see. We show them the contract after the firm signed, and look at, see. But there were some holdouts, a few holdouts. As I say, I could get them all, you know. There were 80 or 90%, some of them, you know. I don't think so much for religious reason as for, you know, Chinese are penny pinching, eh? You know, the skin flints. They hang on, you know, to this, because at that time it was only $1.50 a month. And their union due, they wouldn't join, because they were only working for about $30 or $40 a month. I suppose it's only human nature, you know, you get all kinds of people, you see. But I got the most of them. See, the bulk of them. They were very friendly towards me. They treated me nice. You know, whenever I go into a camp, oh, they treated me as guests, special guests, invited me to dinner, and, you know, joined them for dinner and everything.
How did the white workers feel about, you know, the Chinese joining the union?
They want them to join.
They want.
They don't want them to undercut their labor, you see.
Smart men.
Yeah. What we did, and not just organizing, not just raise their benefit. I used to, you know, I used to be like a one-man success. I used to write letters for them, handle their family problems, and, you know, interpret for them, take them down to immigration, or take them, you know. Did all these performed for them for free, for all for their $1.50 a month. See, that's a part of the service, part of the inducement. I get them to join you. Problems, you have trouble, I'll look after it for you.
Thanks to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for featuring us among more than 70 podcasts and broadcasts focused on work and labor across North America. And finally, as always, thanks to the other members of the podcast team, Bailey Garden and Patricia Weir. I'm Rod Mickleborough. We'll see you next time on The Line. Reinforcements
now. That's it for this edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. A roundup of highlights from just a few of the more than 100 Labor Radio shows and podcasts that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. And you can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited this week by Patrick Dixon, Chris Bankard-Browns, and me. I produce the show, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at LaborRadioNet. Find out more on our website at LaborRadioNetwork.org. We really hope you enjoy this show, and we also hope it inspires you to explore the shows in the Labor Radio Podcast Network, more than 100 across the country and now around the world. Ordinary folks who are working hard to air the voices of workers. If you do, please help spread the word about this amazing and growing world of labor radio and podcast shows. Like the show and share it on social media, Sonic Solidarity, if you will. Thanks very much. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock, urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio podcast show. See you next week.